If I may have your attention, please, I think that we should begin. There's not much time left. Tell me if I need to be closer to the microphone, and we'll make this work the best we can. First of all, I'd like to thank all of you for coming. This is the end of a rather grueling, long day, and so thanks for persevering and hanging in here. One of the things that is the most useful as far as what we're trying to do and what we're trying to accomplish here is this. We presume we're talking to mostly heterosexual people and some who don't understand or know very much about homosexuality. On the other hand, there might be a lot of people who do know about some of this. And what we'd like to do as much as anything is to make as many allies as we can. The number of gay people will always be in a minority, and there are many, many, many gay young people in the Mormon Church who are suffering, and they certainly need the assistance and aid of all who can help out. It's useful, we've found, to tell our story, and I've printed my story and put it in those colored folders. Now, it looks like we already have more people than there are folders there. It would be wonderful. At the end, what I'd like you to do is, if you want to take any of the materials, we paid for the printing, and so we really appreciate a contribution to cover the cost. But that's the detailed story with all the gruesome details in it. And what I'm going to do is I'm just going to give you a Reader's Digest version of my story. And I prefer to read it because I can get through it faster without, you know, wandering off the topic. So let's just try that. I did not identify myself as a homosexual until I was a freshman in college. This realization was quite late in life, considering that I had always found the male body more interesting than the female. Perhaps my naivete about myself was due to being a teenager in the 50s when homosexuality was not a topic for discussion or in the news just about every day as it is now. I simply did not have the language and concepts to understand my complex feelings and experiences, and also repression was part of the mix. I was born into a devoutly LDS family. My father was a bishop and a stake president through all of my growing up years. I perceived that to conform to LDS standards, I must really repress all sexual thoughts and temptations, and so that was certainly part of it. I was called to the North British Mission in 1960, and a crisis occurred when I fell in love with my second missionary companion. Charming, handsome, intelligent, and caring, he aroused feelings I had never felt before in such intensity. And I did something radical. I had never told another person about my same-sex attraction, and I decided to tell my companion. I trusted him. I sensed that he would not reject me for being honest, and I was right about that. It was my own experiment in reality testing. He found it curious that I had one inner reality and he had another, but he was baffled as to what we should do about this and how might this affect my future. So consequently, we made a trip to the mission president, and my visit with the mission president was very short and to the point. My mission president told me that Satan would tempt me in this way for the rest of my life, and that my eternal salvation depended on my ability to withstand this temptation. Then he asked me a surprising question, especially surprising for a 20-year-old, and he said, "Elder Teerling, can you get an erection?" And I said, "Yes, I can." And he says, "Then you are expected to marry, and your marriage is also essential for your eternal salvation." After that, he made a list of things that would be guides for me to help my way through this whole process. And let me just read four of these. There were more. Number one, never tell another person about my same-sex attraction from this day on. Number two, never seek the company of other homosexuals. Never read any psychological literature about homosexuality because it was of the devil. And number four, never consult a psychotherapist or a counselor because their work was of the devil as well. If ever I felt in need of counsel, I should seek it through church authorities. Okay, considering what we just heard in the last session, look at the isolation. You're all on your own. I was a conscientious and early missionary, yet this time of my greatest commitment to Mormonism, I still had doubts about Mormonism. In one moment of deep reflection towards the end of my mission, I saw two roads that strongly beckoned to me, but I must resist to go down those roads. And those two roads I labeled one, intellectual apostasy. I had a curious mind. And the other is homosexuality. After my mission, I returned to the University of Utah and broke two of the directives given to me by my mission president. I obtained counseling at the University of Utah Counseling Center, and I presented myself as a devout Mormon, and my concern was whether heterosexual marriage was an obtainable objective for me. His approach, as I see it now, was to enable me to attain my goal of marriage, so the therapy went in that direction. I suspect that nowadays a secular counselor might have gone in a different direction, perhaps presenting an option of living an openly gay life and settling down with a gay partner. But had I even chosen that goal, I believe my counselor would have supported my choice, but the thought never, ever occurred to me to do such a thing. Besides that, I'd be bucking a very strong current if I chose that path. Well, what I learned from my counseling experience is, number one, I was not a bad person because I experienced same-sex attraction. Number two, homosexuality is not a disease, and that trying to change my orientation would be chasing an illusion. Number three, marriage was possible, though it would be less sexually satisfying, and it would take considerable effort on my part to make it work. Number four, I must never tell my future wife that I was gay if the marriage was to work out at all. So I was stuck with hiding my orientation from the person I was expected to be the closest to. And number five, question I asked it, was, would my orientation disqualify me from being a high school teacher, which was my chosen profession? And he says, by no means, no. Everyone has a sexuality, and kids are off limits, and that's all there is to it. So I became a high school teacher. That I never expected to change my orientation really saved me much pain and suffering. I've met many gay men who have had their self-esteem demolished because they believed that change was possible. Some went through reparative therapy, a clandestine procedure conducted at BYU. And in my estimation, from what I've heard about it, it amounts to changing behavior through torture. I met my wife, and we married in Salt Lake Temple. The first few years had its exhilarating moments. We bought a house, I had a new job, and the baby was soon on the way. I met all of the expectations of family and church, and I felt like, wow, I've really achieved the American dream, and it proves I'm a successful man. The first crisis in my marriage occurred when my faith in Mormonism collapsed. At the excommunication trial, the stake president asked if I sustained the general authorities and the prophet of the church, and to that I answered, no. That very one word got me excommunicated. That excommunication was excruciatingly painful to my parents and family and created a gulf between my family and I that lasted through most of the rest of my life. The marriage survived that crisis because when my wife examined the evidence against Mormonism, she found it convincing as well. After 7 years of marriage and two beautiful daughters, the second big crisis came along when my wife accidentally discovered that I was gay. What I did is I kept myself sane during that time by keeping a journal and talking openly to my journal. And she found it and read it and brought it to my attention. What I'd like to say about that is it's a very cruel thing to subject any woman to this experience. Marriages with a gay spouse are inherently unstable, and the majority of them fail. It suggests that what happens to the innocent wife does not matter from the point of view of the church, even if she never discovers the actual deception. I enjoyed fatherhood, and I was determined to raise my two daughters, and I stayed in the relationship until my youngest daughter was ready to move away and to attend college. My wife and I both tried our very best to make a go of it, but the relationship slowly deteriorated to the point we both knew we would both be happier to end the marriage. 3 years after my divorce, I met my companion, Paul, who you'll hear from later, and we've been together now for 15 years. Last summer, we got married in California, and this official status lasted for all of 8 hours until we crossed the Nevada state line. However, we're still married in the state of California. That is, unless the ballot measure to amend the Constitution in California is approved, and it's a very close toss-up at the present time. So we'll have to say whether Paul and I stay married in California. Okay, now I wish to change the topic, and for the rest of the time I'll not be using the written material. And so what I want to do is carry out a little inquiry with you. We put a questionnaire on your seat, and I hope you've given them some thought. And let me tell you where this is coming from. And it was an example just yesterday. It happens all the time. Just yesterday, a person at this conference got me seated in place. First question fired at me, "When did you know you're homosexual?" And to that, I simply said, "When did you know that you were heterosexual?" So I'd like you to think about that. I'm presuming that the majority here are heterosexual simply because the majority in the population are. So, do you remember when you decided to be when you knew you were heterosexual? And the next question is, did you remember making a choice about, gee, should I be gay? Should I be straight? Can't make up my mind today. It's a really hard choice. So, I'd like to hear from you. Do any of you remember making a decision to be heterosexual? Anyone remember deciding to do that? Why should it be any different with gay people? Every gay person I've talked to says, that's the most absurd thing that I ever chose this. Most of them say, I think I can trace it clear back to childhood. When I look at my life in reverse, I can certainly do that. The evidence was there. I didn't know quite how to interpret it. So that's one of the first things. The church, you see, in its relationship with gay people, presumes that it's a chosen thing and that you choose to be gay and you choose to be sinful and that it's a matter of choice. If there's anything that I'd like to convey to people is it's pretty absurd notion to know that, to think that it's a chosen thing. Okay, now for another bit of inquiry here. How many of you are left-handed? Okay, so that's the minority population in this room. And what I'd like to ask all of you left-handers is, do you remember making a choice about being left-handed? Okay, most of you said, no, I don't. Do any of you remember making a choice? Oh, I think I'll be right-handed. Okay, next question is, do you think there's a possibility that some kind of biology or genetics goes on that determines whether you're right-handed or left-handed? How many of you think that there might be some biological determinant? Raise your hand if you think there is. Okay, we have a majority here. That's quite interesting. Okay, I'm going to go to my old-fashioned technology. It's called an overhead projector.
You were a high school teacher, and you know overhead projector?
Yes.
Okay, so what we're going to look at here is, we need a microphone. What we're going to look at here is the matter of looking at two different traits that are kind of parallel to each other. So handedness, people come in two different kinds. One is left-handed, the minority population, and right-handed, the predominant one. And the same with homosexuality. In the case of homosexuality, it's the minority, and the majority are heterosexual. As far as the number of homosexuals, the best estimate is it's about 5%. And it's also interesting to know that there are about twice as many men that are homosexual than women. So it's a 2-to-1 ratio. Okay, now, there's a lot of interesting information on this sheet, and I'll have a copy of it. You can look at that later. I'm cutting through as much as possible, hoping we can get to question and answer, because I'm sure there's plenty. But let's just look at three things. Is there a correlation with certain things with homosexuality? For example, race. Are black people more likely to be homosexual than whites? Another is geography. Are people born in Holland more likely to be homosexual than anywhere else on Earth? And if we look at one aspect of culture and say, are Catholics more likely to be homosexual than Mormons? Well, whenever this is examined, it's found to be completely, thank you for the signal, it's completely uniform across the whole globe. Every investigation finds out the proportion of gay people is the same everywhere. And it's the same regardless of race, geography, or culture. What does that say to me? It says this is one human characteristic that seems to be ever present no matter where you go. And there's something very fundamental going on here. Most scientists now simply regard it as one of the variabilities of human nature. Some people have brown eyes, others have blue. Well, let's look at some additional information about twins. And it's this. Does homosexuality run in families? The thing is, how many times have you said, oh, he's got his grandpa's nose, but he sure has his grandma's eyes? Well, we know that things run in families. How about homosexuality? It does run in families. Doesn't that suggest that there is some inheritance going on? As a matter of fact, the probability, if you take two gay brothers, same family, two gay brothers, what is the probability that if you have one brother that's gay, that there will be another? It's 22%, whereas we learned in the population generally, it's about 5%. So there is an increased probability just if you're someone in the same family, suggesting, well, if the probability goes up simply because you're brothers and had the same parents passing down the same DNA, you're more likely to be gay. That's a suggestion there's something genetic going on here. Now, next, if we look at the situation with monozygotic twins, that's a big fancy word, but what we're talking about is identical twins. In the case of identical twins, they have exactly the same DNA. All right, if they have exact copies of each other's DNA, it says if it's purely genetic, both of them should be gay. But what we find is only half of them are. That suggests something else is going on. That could be culture, but I'd also like you to consider it might be biological in the sense that something might be happening to the embryo and fetus during the process of development. In other words, the shaping of the brain. Okay, so that could be the other part. But we can't just ignore this 50%. What that is, that's a very high probability, and that's a strong suggestion that indeed there is heredity playing a part in this, but heredity is not the whole picture. All right, there have been a number of lines of things that have been investigated. And so, I can just sit here and talk. So let's look at some of the other things that might have some influence or in what scientists have examined. And I'm not going to discuss all of them because I'd really like to get to questions and answers as soon as possible. We've already talked about twin studies, and so I'd like to go to another one, which I found particularly interesting, and it's gender-conforming behavior. This study was done starting with children who were in lower grades of elementary school. And what it was based on is pediatricians, teachers, and parents can quite easily pick out male children, I'm only talking about male homosexuality here, as being effeminate. Well, they get labeled as sissies when they're in school. And so this study got the pejorative name of the Sissy Boy Study. Okay, so what they did is they identified a large number of these sissy boys. How did they do it? To make it objective, they had to meet 10 different criteria to be put into the study. I'll give you an example of just one of the criteria. Sissy boys don't involve in rough and tumble play. But the sissy boys, but the other boys do. Okay, so that was one way of distinguishing one from the other. Okay, so they identified these boys in early elementary school. They then followed them to age 18 and found that the particular behavior pattern we're talking about was one of the most stable characteristics found in human nature. In other words, at age 18, they were still identified as being sissy boys, had been all their life. Okay, any trait that is persists from the time of early elementary school to 18 years of age, says, hey, that sticks around. That's amazing. The most amazing thing after all of this is that when they interviewed the boys and asked them, what is your sexual orientation, 80% said, I'm gay. We don't know about the others. Perhaps they didn't want to reveal, but just the same. 80% says something. Well, how about our old stereotype? Oh, yes, you can tell, and the kids can mock it. They can say, oh, he's so gay. And yes, there is something that indeed effeminate boys, many of them are gay. But is that true of all gay people? And it's not. A very large proportion of them pass perfectly as straight people. My partner Paul and I always passed as being straight individuals. Never did I get any flack about that whatsoever. Okay, so that's another suggestion. The interesting thing in addition to this is a lot of parents say, when did you first notice this? They said, when my boy was two. I know a person particularly who was talking about her son and what happened with that boy. She says, as soon as he could walk, he put on my shoes, put on my dress. I went traipsing around the house and I couldn't get him out of those clothes. And that went on for the rest of his life. And so she had the clue right then and there. And yes, he was gay. Okay, here is another one that I think is rather interesting. And then I'm going to leave it at that. And it has to do with the fact that we have, oh, by the way, with this gender-conforming behavior, it was confirmed in 14 other studies done in various countries around the world. Okay, another study that has also been confirmed widely across the whole planet, just about, was first done by Blanchard and Casson. And in this study, they observed that if a boy had one older brother, the probability of being gay was 2% greater than if there was an older sister, or if there wasn't any older children at all. And what was very interesting is, for each older brother, it goes up 2%. Well, I have three older brothers, so I guess that put me ahead by 6%. Okay, so there is something absolutely going on. Now, how do you explain this, and how do you do the experiment? The thing is, it's not possible to do experiments on embryos and fetuses. That is just beyond all ethics possible. scientists can suggest a perhaps a mechanism, and the suggested mechanism is this. The baby's developing produces certain chemical substances that are directed by their DNA or their genes. And those substances go to the baby's brain and sexualize the brain. We know what part of the brain it is. It's found in the hypothalamus. Okay, but those same chemicals, probably proteins, go across the membrane of the placenta into the mother's blood. Well, it's an antigen to her immune system, and she builds antibodies against it. Now, this is if it leaks across the membrane. Okay, next boy comes along. What happens? She has antibodies against the very substance that sexualizes his brain. And so what happens is it comes back and fouls up the mechanism in some way and alters the sexual orientation. One last thing, and that is there have been numerous studies done with animals in which the scientists have been able to manipulate the sexual orientation of a wide variety of mammals, anywhere from rats to goats. And they can change the sexual orientation by manipulating the hormones during the development of the embryo and fetus, something no one should ever do, of course, with a human baby. What that suggests is the sexualization of the brain probably happens during the time that the fetus is developing, and there are many things that possibly could go wrong in that process of sexualizing the brain. And just to summarize all of this, we have various kinds of evidence that points in the direction of a cause of homosexuality. Do we really know? Absolutely not. It's mostly a mystery. How good is the evidence? I don't think it's terribly great. It simply points in that direction. I think it might be important for this reason. It would be nice if the Mormon Church would acknowledge, oh my goodness, there is some scientific evidence that indeed homosexuality has a biological origin. Okay, and this might be useful for you, and that's why I'm talking about it. But when we finish here, I'd like you to just consider this one ethical question. We've been talking about individuality, and people should acknowledge their own individuality. How does it hurt someone else if this person is attracted to the same sex? How does it hurt anybody else? Next, the other thing is, what if this person chooses to love another person of the same sex and form a relationship with them for life? What's the big deal with that? How does it destroy families? How does it affect other people? And here we keep saying that it destroys families, it destroys families. Paul and I sit down and we say, well, I wonder whose family we decimated tonight. And we've never been able to answer that question because we don't quite know which ones we did. So maybe you can help me find out which families we decimated. Okay, I'm now going to turn the time over to Paul. And something I just realized is this comes out of here, Paul. And if you want to, well, just move it over to the podium.
First of all, I want to thank all of you for coming. As Dick said, it's been a wonderful day, but we're toward the end. Thank you. And I want to thank Dick. I've heard this presentation a number of times because we've had the good fortune of being asked to talk and present. And I've always learned some new and interesting things. What I want to do, and it will be a very abbreviated presentation because the time is slipping by. We need to get out of here so they can set up for our banquet. And we want to give you some time for Q&A. So I've got a bunch of cards here and it's going to be fast. But I want to hit on some important things that I think is in so critical that we all understand. Now, one thing I know, that it's very unlikely that the folks that attend this conference, and this is our fourth, are in any kind of official church position. Maybe so. But you are really closeted. But we all have neighbors. We all have family. We all have friends. We all have young people that we know in a variety of ways that we can be a tremendous assistance and help. What I tried to do in this presentation was give you a brief outline of my life. 60 years ago, when I was a kid growing up in Lehigh, it was a very, very different world. It was a wonderful world as a kid. There were 3,000 people. It was more like a tribe than a town. It's not that way now. 30,000, I think. But we felt safe. We had a lot of freedom. We didn't have a lot of adults watching and supervising us. In lots of ways, it was a wonderful experience. I very early on learned to start having a dual identity, given the terminology of the previous presenter. I called it two different lives. You know, all kids have secrets from their parents. We all know that. But I deepened that because I was so confused by many of the feelings and the things that were going on. I was one of the sissy boys. I'd come home from school crying because I didn't know how to throw a ball except like a girl. And I didn't know how to hit a ball, and frankly, I didn't want to. And I was teased, and it was not easy, but I didn't know what was going on. Back then, in the 40s and 50s, there wasn't language that we have now. And certainly my parents and grandparents that I lived with, my dad died when I was 6, so we moved to Lehigh, my mother and I, to live with my grandparents. Sex was not talked about at all, let alone homosexuality. I think if I said homosexuality to my grandparents, they wouldn't have a clue of their past, but they wouldn't know what I was even talking about. So it really is a different world. What I want to emphasize is that while the experiences I had were unique to me, in a lot of ways, because of when I grew up, a lot of the things that I experienced are very likely the same kinds of things that a lot of other gay and lesbian young people in Mormonism and in our culture are experiencing. First of all, there's one big difference, and we've talked about it in other sessions. They have the internet. They can get information that I couldn't get until I was a freshman at BYU and I snuck out some books at the library and read about homosexuality. And it talked about, first of all, it was a mental illness in those days. People could be institutionalized and were. And the other was that men would hide in bushes and jump out and molest little boys. And I read that and I thought, I don't hide in any bushes. I don't want to molest anybody, certainly not children or hurt them. But that was the level of understanding. Now, that's changed a great deal, fortunately. But the thing that I want to emphasize is that I learned very early on to hide and keep under surface many of the things that I was feeling. Think back when you were a child and would go to the Saturday matinees, and it was, well, in my day, Roy Rogers and Gene Autry, so that dates me. But I was always watching the men. And when there would be a musical and the chorus had come on, guess who I was always looking at? It wasn't the girls, even though they were very attractive and you know, I can understand why boys would get excited, but it was the men. Well, I didn't know what to do with that. And then when I got to be a teenager, I got in such a conflict because of it, and lots of reasons I won't go into. I became one of the best little boys in Lehigh. The kids used to call me Pope Paul. And it was because I really wanted to be very righteous. And part of that was when Dad died, my mother took me aside the morning after he died. And bless her heart, she did what she thought she needed to do. They'd been married in the temple. And so she told me that if we would be good and we would do the right things and follow the teachings of the church, we would be together again in heaven with my daddy. That's pretty powerful for a six-year-old. And there were some other things that went on that I won't go into. But anyway, I started to hide. I hid from myself in many ways. One of the things that Dick didn't mention, but we've talked a lot about, is people that are gay accept all the homophobic stuff that the culture and the church puts out, just like everybody else. And so when we begin to realize that, hey, we're not heterosexual, we do have homosexual desires, that coming out process has to begin in your own heart and mind before you can begin to move out to other people. And it isn't easy. I graduated from high school, went to BYU, the same old story. It's kind of like an obituary that you read often in Salt Lake especially. Went to BYU, went on a mission, served an honorable mission, fell in love with my second companion. I don't know what it was about first, but my second companion, he was handsome, he was a good man, and I didn't know what it was. I was so naive and young, I had no clue. But as I've looked back after all these years, he was the first person I really loved. Well, he was straight, and that's very common too, for gay men to fall in love with straight men. And I went and confessed to my mission president, and he kept me there. I really thought he might send me home, but he didn't. And eventually I became an assistant to the second mission president that came along. So I got an honorable release, came home, married the woman, the girl that I had met before my mission. And in about 4 months, I realized that what I had been taught and told by church leaders, that if I would marry, be righteous, do everything that I was told by the church, and be faithful, I would be fixed and cured. My problem would somehow vanish, go away. It was like, if Jesus can heal the lepers and raise the dead, he ought to be able to fix a Lehigh queer. And I believed that. And I came out to my wife. It was very hard. I was clinically depressed for a month or more after we'd been married, because I began to realize nothing's changed. I still have the same feelings about men. I love her, and I'm grateful that we're married. And we eventually ended up with 5 children, including my son, Brent, that many of you know and that's here today. And I'm grateful with all my heart for my children. I can't imagine my life without them and my 10 grandchildren. So that's a part of all of this story that means a great deal to me. But I struggled with this whole thing in a 30-year marriage. I've told other friends that it was always like a cloud. in the marriage. At times, it was a big cloud and caused me, more than her, I think, but certainly caused me a lot of anguish and pain and confusion. And then at times it was a little cloud and it was not a big issue, but it was always there. Anyway, to make a long story short, I graduated from BYU, went to the University of Utah, got a master's degree in social work, worked a year in primary hospital, and then on to Granite School District, where I worked for 21 years as a school social worker and 11 years as an elementary school principal. And all of that 33-year career, I was frightened that somehow somebody would figure me out. And in those days, when Richard and I got together 15, 16 years ago, we asked an attorney in a meeting similar to this, could we, he was a teacher, I was a principal, could we be fired in the state of Utah because we were homosexual and gay or gay? And he said yes. So, needless to say, when we moved in together, we had to be very, very, very cautious. And I got so paranoid that the first time I went to the Gay Pride Parade, what, Dick, about 12 years ago, I suppose, I was so frightened to even stand on the sidewalk and watch the parade go by because I was afraid some news group would come along with a camera and take a picture of me, and I'd be called in to the superintendent's office. Now, that's nuts, but that's the level of fear and concern I had about what this was all going to mean. Some of that has changed, fortunately, in the ensuing years. But, folks, there are kids out there that are hurting, and we don't know it, and they don't know how to let us know. But when someone comes to you, and a mother asked me yesterday, what could I and should I do if one of my children came to me, say when she was, he or she was 16, 17, and said, Mom, I think I'm gay. I think I'm a lesbian. And the first thing that came to mind was love them. Know that they did not choose to be homosexual. They cannot change being homosexual. They can make decisions about how that plays out in their lives, of course, but they can't change their sexual orientation. One of the unfortunate things that the Mormon Church perpetuates, and then I'll close, is the idea that being gay, or what they call same-sex attraction, is not something you are, it's something that you do. And if you quit doing it, then you aren't. And that means you can make a change. And some of you have heard of Evergreen, which is an organization that makes a huge attempt to do that. 3 weeks ago, we had a potluck dinner at our home for gay and lesbian friends. We meet once a month around the valley. And they came to our home, and after we'd eaten and had a chance to kind of settle down, we had a discussion. And there were some things that I was just absolutely appalled when I heard these people talk. Two of them had been a part of this Evergreen endeavor. It cost them a great deal of money. One fellow flew from, if you can believe, flew from St. Joe, Missouri, every week to attend one of these meetings in Salt Lake. because they didn't have that in the central states, where incidentally I served my mission and began to get my major doubts about Mormonism. But he came every week for years. Then he realized that it was a great place to cruise, but it was not a very good place to change. And he had children too. He eventually divorced, as I did, 30 years after marriage. It was very hard on my children. It was very hard for Margaret, my ex-wife. It was a very, very tough time in our lives. But we've weathered it. We've gotten through it because of love. And this fellow mentioned that, and I'd never heard this before, that he was told that if he was to ever want to return to the church, of course he had to pay his back tithing, he also had to be rebaptized, of course. And this is the part that really pissed me off. He had to marry a woman again. And then that led to others saying, they're still telling young missionaries that come home and go in and confess, Bishop, I completed my mission, but I think I'm gay. I think I don't know what to do about it. They're still telling many of these young men, get married, have children, live a righteous life, all of that. And one of the reasons I was so angry is that 10 years ago, in a meeting a little larger than this, one of the general authorities of the church denied that. We asked him specifically, are you still telling young men to do this? And he said no. Well, we heard about lying today. The other thing that about drove me wild is that as we were talking, Brent came to the potluck with us because he loves the company of our friends. And he said, Dad, I don't think you know this, but when I went on my mission, I was told, when they talk about their worthiness and family and all, that if I would be a very faithful, good, obedient, righteous missionary, his father, me, would be changed into a straight man and rejoin the church. I sort of went ballistic because I never had heard that they would put that on a young man, that kind of, in a sense, burden, that what he did would have anything to do with me and with Richard. Now, if that's not criminal, I don't really know what is. Criminal in the sense that it destroys people and lives. I don't know if there's any law against it. Nobody's going to press charges. But it's wrong. And Brent told me this 3 weeks ago. So this is what we're up against, folks. There's a great deal of ignorance. There's a great deal of prejudice. It's a hot button issue, as we well know. All you need to do is read the paper and look at the television, see what's going on in California. And incidentally, it is a toss-up. We've contributed to what little we can. We're both retired, but we've contributed to helping out the folks that are fighting this. The Mormon Church has invested, I don't know if it's invested, but they've given millions. And it's something that is very, very serious. I think what's going to happen, we've had friends as we've gone to California and different places, what on earth makes you want to live in Salt Lake and in Utah? Well, it's because we have wonderful friends. We consider you part of that network of friends. We have straight and gay friends. We're active and involved in our church, First Unitarian here in town, and they're wonderful. They've never made any issue of the fact that Dick and I are a couple. We can go to church and I can hold his hand and not be asked to leave. Now, there are plenty of places around here that that is not the case. So we have many wonderful experiences that we're grateful for. And we want, in the remaining years we have, to do whatever we can to help young, middle-aged, old. We know them all. Dick and I were advisors to the West High Gay Straight Alliance for 4 years. Some of you who are Salt Lake residents remember all that hoopla about East High? God, what a... Anyway, interestingly enough, after Salt Lake canceled all the clubs, extracurricular clubs, the only clubs that existed, and it was after school, and we rented the buildings, was the Gay Straight Alliance at East and West High. All the others, even the chess club, couldn't meet. Now, if that isn't nuts, I don't know what is. But anyway, we went and met wonderful kids and had a tremendous experience with these young men and women. When Dick and I would walk by the seminary right by West High, and we'd look over there, and I'd say to him, "That's where we need to go. That's where we're needed." But the chances of us getting in for more than about 5 minutes were pretty remote. So we went on to West High and ran our club, or the kids ran it, and we were the advisors. Anyway, that's a little bit of the story. The experience I had years and years ago is very different in many ways. I know that. And in lots of ways, I'm grateful it's different. But in many ways, and I think especially in Mormonism, it is not. These kids know that their church is fighting that amendment in California. They know. And they know that they've been called abominable and perverts and deviants. And I could go on. And those are the politically correct terms that I can say in a mixed company. But it's something that we need to be aware of and try any way you possibly can, individually and in your families, in your organizations, whatever, to support and to help these kids know. First of all, they didn't choose their sexual orientation. Get that in your heads. They did not choose it. And they can't change it, nor should they. They can be happy, productive, committed in a relationship as we have been, and very grateful. I was 55 when I met Dick, and he was a little younger. And I've told some others facetiously that it was kind of like a Unitarian miracle, and we don't have many of those, that we met. And it was through a mutual friend. And it's been a wonderful 15 years together. So we're not all suicidal. We're not all trying to hurt other people, young people or anybody else. We've never recruited, and as far as I know, like Dick said, we've never yet ruined a straight marriage. And if anybody can tell me who they are, I'll be very happy to apologize and tell them I'm very sorry I didn't know what I'd done. because it is so absurd that that's one of the arguments that's used, that we're a danger and that we ruin people's lives. So thank you for listening. I appreciate very much the opportunity to talk. Now, if we've got any time, and I hope we do, a little time, I know they're going to come in and say, get out of here quick. Questions and answers. Yes, sir. Okay, I'm so glad you mentioned that, because I failed to mention two things, and I'll just do it very quickly. We have handouts.
Did all of you hear the question?
Did you hear the question? The question is, this gentleman said he has a friend who has some real issues about this whole thing of homosexuality. And what?
A general authority?
No, he's up the ladder. Okay, but it's still a huge issue. Let me read you something quickly. This is in this issue's of the Expositor. Is that what we are? The new Expositor. This is a quotation from Boyd Packer. The danger I speak of is from the gay and lesbian movement, the feminist movement, both of which are relatively new, and the ever-present challenge from the so-called scholars and intellectuals. Our local leaders must deal with all three of these at the same time, and in each case, the members of the church who are turning to these practices and have the conviction that the church is somehow doing something wrong to hurt them, or that the church is not being fair and kind enough to them. I would respectfully tell Boyd Packer he's absolutely right. And we are a danger to a patriarchal society that puts women down and threatens men in lots of ways. And I know I was a bishop as well as a high councilman and the whole nine yards. I've been there. I've done that. And so the pressures are on men as well as women. So anyway, I don't know. I don't know if that's something that's going on with this gentleman. It could be. It might not be. The other thing I want to say quickly, and then I really will quit. We often hear, or used to hear, more than we do now, about the gay agenda. Have you ever heard of that? The gay agenda. And often it's like we recruit kids because we can't have our own. Well, I'm a proof that's not true. Had five, and Dick's got two. So that doesn't fly. And then the other thing is that we recruit, and Dick and I both said we never did get a toaster. And I guess it's because we never recruited anybody. Believe me, we don't need to recruit. There's plenty of Mormon families producing gay kids every day of the year. Okay, basic gay rights. Basic protection from discrimination. Freedom from government intrusion into our personal lives. The expectation of personal and private physical safety and protection from hate-motivated crimes. The recognition of our family relationships And that includes men like us as well as couples who have small children. The right to parent. Access to health care. 7, schools that care about and protect all of their students. 8, a fair chance for every child. And 9, human rights for all. I fail to see how that's very radical. It means that we all must continue to work for justice and what is right for all people, our brothers and sisters who are gay and lesbian, as well as everyone else. Thanks for your time. Oh.
I don't know that we're being shooed out of here, are we? So let's answer questions until they shoo us out of here. I'd like to respond to the question about if someone is very ferocious about homosexuality, do they have their own sexual issues? I would suggest, if you haven't seen it, is to watch the wonderful film Angels in America. The most vicious, awful man in the movie is someone who is gay and who denies that he was gay. And his name was Roy Cohen.
Roy Cohen. And if you know who he is, it really is. Because he was an assistant to Joe McCarthy during those hearings.
Next question. Did all of you hear that? We don't have a second microphone, but the gentleman said excommunication was a gift because what it did is it freed him from Mormonism to live a fulfilling life.
Yes, sir.
One of the images that the society or it's an excellent question, and one we've puzzled about ourselves, because we have a rather limited, partly because of our age, but partly because we choose where and who we spend our time with. And so we can't claim to be representatives of all the gay community. I don't know that anybody can. Because there are, as you well know, if you've looked at the television coverage of the gay pride parade, there's a whole bunch of folks, and some are outrageous. And the majority, vast majority of people are, quote, just as normal looking as all of us here.
I would like to give an evolutionary answer because I was a biology teacher, and it's this. There is a lot of evidence that males are programmed to some degree to spread their seed, so to speak. On the other hand, females are programmed to look after the young, and what they demand of the male is that they stick around and help. And what they get, you see, if they stick around and help, is sex. Okay, now let's consider this. How many straight men can find all that many willing women? In the gay community, the men are always willing. And so consequently, I believe that it's true to a degree that there is more promiscuity among gay men. There are some men who never want to bond and form a pair like us.
And we know some of them.
And there are others who say, that's not the life for me, and settle down with another partner.
So I don't know if that answers your question, but it really is a wide spectrum.
Just a follow-up question. Since you both have children,
yeah.
Is there any correlation between your emotional sexuality and your offspring and their
not that I'm aware of, but I'm not sure about my 10 grandkids. They're young, for one thing. My oldest grandson is 17. They go right down to 8. Yeah, Jaden's 8. Isn't that old?
I'm not talking to my daughter.
Okay. So it's a good question. I don't know.
I could only.
The odds are that eventually somebody in my family, in the next couple of generations,
If we look back at the data that suggests that there's something genetic going on and that runs in families, I think there might be an increased probability.
Yeah.
But still, when you consider that increased probability, it's really very low, and so I wouldn't worry about it.
Okay, this young lady has a question.
My best friend many years ago, I always figured that she was probably a lesbian, but closet. She was a woman. And her daughter ended up marrying my son.
Oh.
And she turns out to be bisexual.
Okay.
Her aunt, the mother's sister, is also lesbian. And so there you go, all in one little group of people there. And you didn't cover the topic of bisexuality at all. How did it fit?
Good question. Go ahead.
We covered as much as we could. We've taken up an hour, and we left the women out altogether. I might first say that the causes in women is totally different. Everything that I had to say does not apply to women.
Much more fluid.
And another is women are very fluid. I'll give you an example of how fluid. We know a woman who is in a lesbian relationship, and she says, "I really am attracted to men, not women." She said, "If I could find a man who was as kind and gentle as my lesbian partner, I would marry him." Well, she's fluid enough, and that suggests a kind of bisexuality in women that seems to be more likely in women than in men. Men, I think the number of bisexuals is probably quite small, and so people are either straight or they are gay. But for women, I think there is more likely that there is bisexuality. And there's a whole lot of fluidity between the two.
I don't mean to be crude, but I remember once hearing, in terms of the sexual thing, especially among the young, women have to have a reason, like Dick explained. Men just have to have a place. And that's true with gay people.
Yes, sir.
Has anyone in the gay community considered just coming up with a new name between two folks and then requesting rights to that?
And they have. I know of one prominent gay leader that says what everyone should have is civil marriage. Because civil marriage is a civil right. None of us go to our bishop, our priest, our rabbi, our religious leader, and get a marriage certificate. Where do we go? We go down to the courthouse. That's a part of government. Okay? And then you get into the marriage thing, which usually implies religious and church involvement. And that's a whole different ball of wax. Because they're entitled to do whatever they and the people that attend their denomination, I believe, feel is appropriate and right. The Unitarian Church has been acknowledging and performing same-sex marriages since 1967. Some churches never will, unless things change drastically. So I don't know if that answers it.
Well, a new name, don't call it marriage.
Yeah.
A civil union doesn't
It doesn't quite do it. Maybe you can come up with a name that'll really...
Good answer.
Good answer.
Thank you very much.
Other questions or comments? I know that the time is moving.
Yeah. I just recently finished the Master's degree in psychology. It was evergreen, and I'm wondering how these practitioners and these therapists get licensed.
Good question.
And who against that standards and psychology practice. Yeah,
being a professional social worker, at one time licensed as a clinical therapist, I don't know how they maintain their accreditation or the licensing kinds of things. Oh, okay.
It's not. Very often you don't have any sort of psychologist or any sort of mental.
Oh, okay.
It is individuals, and then they're led or supervised by some church person, or a high priest or someone. There are a few LDS County Services people who kind of, on the side, have to do with it, but the church does not actively confirm it, nor is there really any sort of mental health professional overseeing. It's a bunch of amateurs.
Right. Yeah. Yeah, that's nothing
yes.
new.
I'd
heard once, and I couldn't believe it, that one of the things Evergreen does is try to teach men how to play softball. And if I guess they learn, they're fixed.
I like it. You see, you get behind them. You hold the bat like this.
And you say to your partner, closer. But I also wondered if in terms of women who are lesbian that go to this thing, and I don't know if there are many, do they send them down to the Relief Society crafts class to learn how to make Christmassy things? I mean...
I've said enough.
I see people leaving, and so I think probably it's time to end it. If you want to gather around and ask additional questions, you're very welcome to do that.
Please come and help yourself. We'd appreciate it.
Well, I hope we didn't take too much time out of there wanting to get in here.